Hi, this is Anne Merchant, and welcome to The Sounds of Science, the podcast brought to you by the National Academy of Sciences, the National Academy of Engineering, the Institute of Medicine, and the National Research Council, collectively known as the National Academies. As we move into the closing week of Olympic competition in Beijing, it's clear that the whole world has been paying a lot of attention to China. Indeed, we've been keeping an eye on the country for some time now, and the focus has not always been on their athletic competition. With the world's largest armed force at its disposal, we have worried about their military might. With a propensity for burning coal, we've fretted over their environmental policies. And with a population exceeding 1 billion, we have carefully assessed their purchasing power. But China, nevertheless, remains inscrutable to us on many levels. Equally mysterious is India, the only other country on Earth to claim more than a billion citizens. Here, too, we have kept a wary watch on changes in their political and educational landscape, as well as on their burgeoning economic prospects. But if we are to gain a much-needed understanding of either China or India and their respective global goals, we'd be wise to do so within the context of their history, their religion, their culture, and their politics. Kevin Finneran, Editor-in-Chief of Issues in Science and Technology, a publication of the National Academies and the University of Texas at Dallas, has spent some time exploring Asia's economic groundswell, and more especially, looking at why we find these countries so tough to read.
The United States always has a difficulty understanding any culture other than its own. We're just culture-centric, and we assume that they'll think the way that we do, or they'll operate the way that we do, and that therefore they'll follow the same path that we follow. And China and India are not that similar to one another, and they're both very different from the United States. The tendency is just to overreact to little pieces of information and not have much perspective on the two countries.
And as Finneran points out, we've fallen into the habit of filling these gaps in our understanding with a healthy dose of trepidation. Headlines warn that we'll be outsourcing our future to China and India, leaving us to wonder whether they'll eat our lunch, while others suggest that they just might take us to dinner. In many ways, it's not an either-or proposition, but more like an and.
Because they're so large, there's a tendency to see them as terribly threatening. If you have a manufacturing job and you worry about it going overseas, then China in particular seems a tremendous threat. But the United States economy is still more than four times as large as China and India's economy put together. So yes, they're growing, and yes, they're going to be important, but if you're a U.S. multinational corporation and you're looking at the two biggest markets in the world, this is a tremendous opportunity. You're also looking at a lot of talent, a lot of potential for growth. If you're selling refrigerators, there aren't that many more refrigerators to sell in the United States. Everybody already has one upstairs and one in the basement. China, many of the people don't have refrigerators. They don't have automobiles. They don't have computers. They don't have many of the appliances that we'd like to sell. So they see these as great markets, and the fact that they're growing is an enormous opportunity.
There are many forces at play in both China and India, some of which explain their similarities, while others define their differences. In particular, their different social customs, varying government policies and practices, and individual cultural histories combine to create complex systems that make it tough for outsiders to keep up with developments in either country.
One of the things about China is that it's an authoritarian, top-down government type of place where the trains run on time. And so they're able to grow very quickly. India is very different. It is a very democratic country. There's a lot of power vested in the smaller political units of the country. So India just works much more slowly and much more indirectly. Now, there are some people that think that that's an advantage because they think that China, there's an inherent tension between an authoritarian top-down political structure and an entrepreneurial capitalist economy, so that you can impose all these things, but at some point it's just going to break.
Who and what these countries are and how they behave is a product of chock-a-block change. Finneran quotes journalist Edward Luce when he talks about India's legacy of Gandhi and Nehru, the enduring presence of the caste system, the rise of Hindu nationalism, the remnants of the British-derived civil service system, and the uneven emergence of a modern educated class of tech-savvy workers. These and other factors have all influenced India's modern philosophies.
One of the troubles that India had through the 1960s and 70s was that it had this tremendous belief that it had to invent everything itself, that that was the way to grow its economy, was to be independent. It turned out that that is not the best way to grow an economy.
A review of China's recent history is every bit as mind-boggling. The rise of Mao Zedong, the alliance with the Soviet Union, the split from the Soviet Union, the complete restructuring of the economy, the upheaval of the social order in the Cultural Revolution, a second restructuring of the economy, the birth and repression of a democracy movement, and the high-wire strategy of maintaining an authoritarian political system with a free market economy. China's unique history has produced their current approach to their future, one that is often in marked contrast to the tone and tenor of the American perspective.
Well, one of the things, and this is the trouble that China recognizes in itself, is that because of this top-down government and a lack of freedom, it has not been a very creative culture. They've succeeded economically largely by producing technology that was invented elsewhere and using the intellectual property of other countries.
As Finneran acknowledges, there's no simple way to understand what's happening in these countries. U.S. policymakers must prepare themselves for a long and challenging effort to see beyond the headlines and to aggregate statistics. We must dig deeper into the education data to try to evaluate the quality of recent graduates. We should carefully consider whether recent economic trends will continue in the future. And we need to examine current policies and political trends, teasing out important discrepancies between stated policy and actual practice to gain a better understanding of both China and India. But this is only a beginning, and there are a couple of key takeaways from any analysis of the two countries.
When you look at China, you can see, and at India, you can see at the very best companies, very best workers there, you know, are as good as workers and companies anywhere. And you'd see engineers from the top Chinese and Indian universities, and they'd say, boy, they're terrific. And many of them would come here for their graduate work. And they'd say, boy, if they're all like this, that's how we're going to have our lunch eaten. But it's what happens when you drill down a little bit. When you look beyond that, the quality of education below that very thin top layer is not all that good. India has a problem. They've had tremendous growth in their private engineering schools. And the quality of the engineers coming out are not that good. You know, the little bit we see of India, the Indians, the Chinese that come here, are really not representative of the whole country. You know, if you could think about it, you know, each country has a small European country in it that's very successful, innovative, well-educated, you know, globally savvy. But they also have another billion people who are in a completely different state.
The diverging political and economic models speak to many of the differences between China and India. While the one dominates in manufacturing, the other concentrates on the service industry. While the one silences dissent, the other celebrates their messy democracy. But for all their contrasts, the two countries also share certain characteristics. Both are populous Asian nations that are experiencing rapid economic growth. Both are increasingly responsible for and susceptible to international market forces. As Finneran points out, it's as important to deconstruct and analyze these similarities as it is the differences.
They're similar in that they're ambitious now, they're enormous, they see tremendous potential. But they're both countries that, you know, they're young. So they're just experience a pace of change. That's something that the United States experienced, you know, maybe in the 1800s, but is long past for us. So when you try to understand China and India, first you understand their differences, you try to get over preconceptions, and then you get an understanding, and then 2 years later, you've got to adjust that, because both of them, those countries have moved on. The nature of their economies have moved on, their policies, even changes in their culture. They are opening up to the world, and those influences are becoming important.
As we contemplate all that we know and all that remains uncertain about these sometimes inscrutable nations, we might look to one of the simpler but very striking examples of their differences. For a little bit of insight in this season of Olympic competition, maybe you should tune in to watch the closing ceremonies of the 2008 Games.
Actually, one of the Olympics actually highlights one of the curious differences between China and India. I mean, China has become an athletic juggernaut. I mean, they want to participate in all sports. They want gold medals. India is totally indifferent. I mean, India has, for its population, has the lowest production of Olympic medals of any place. So, you know, they like cricket. They've tried to be competitive at that. But virtually nowhere else. You never see, as a country of more than a billion people, they're virtually invisible at the Olympics. It's not the type of thing we think about ordinarily when we think about culture and economics and politics. But it is a way in which the two world's two largest countries, they're very close to one another geographically, are completely different in their attitude towards sport.
A collection of articles on India and China is available in the spring 2000 edition of Issues, found at www.issues.org. My name is Anne Merchant, and you've been listening to The Sounds of Science, the podcast brought to you by the National Academies, advisors to the nation on science, engineering, and medicine. Be sure to visit us at our website at nationalacademies.org, where we have more than 3,000 books and publications available full text to read free online.